When my guest, Amy Willits, went to Haiti in 1986, she planned to write about the violent and oppressive dictatorship of Jean-Claude Duvalier. But just 5 days after she arrived, Duvalier fled and Willits found herself in the midst of a popular uprising. The people's hopes turned into despair when the new government soon showed itself to be one of violence and not reform. Amy Willits stayed in Haiti for the next 2 years, and she's just written a book titled The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. Willits found a country where any attempt at political or social reform was met with a brutal murder. Many times she found herself in a storm of gunfire. She often came upon mutilated bodies in the streets. But Willits was drawn to the bravery of the people living in such adversity. Amy Willits first became intrigued by Haiti when she read Graham Greene's novel The Comedians, which was set during the days of Papa Doc Duvalier in the 60s.
It just seemed like an incredibly dark, mysterious island of corruption and evil to me when I read this book, and that started my interest. And then I started reading the Haitian exile papers, of which there were two at the time. Now there are three major ones. And that seemed to sort of confirm what Greene had said, but they also gave a depth to it and a sort of soap opera feeling to what was happening at that time in Haiti, which was in 1985. And that's when I began to think, well, maybe I'll go down there and just see for myself.
You were rather critical in your book of other journalists down there who stayed at hotels. I guess you seem to raise the idea of the journalist slash tourist who covers events and then goes back to the hotel. Are you critical of that kind of journalism?
Yeah, I'm very critical of it. I don't think it only happens in Haiti, and I don't think it's the fault necessarily of those particular journalists, but more of the structure of journalism where you send in a guy and then you pull him out and he doesn't really have a chance to learn anything about the country and to set things in a context for his readers. And also the awful fact that only when blood is shed really do newspapers consider these countries worthy of their attention. But I also think that, you know, if you're covering a place for a long time over and over, even if you only go there because of bloodshed, you ought to learn the language. You ought to know more people than the ones who speak English. I just think that that's a sort of inexcusable thing. For someone who's sent in suddenly, I can understand it.
Does, though, someone who comes in quickly and leaves after the events are over, though, have a kind of objectivity that a journalist living there might not have?
Well, if you think that objectivity is ignorance, I suppose he does. But otherwise, I mean, I don't consider my book an objective book. It's a book by a writer, not by a journalist in many ways. But I don't believe in objectivity. I think that any news you report has a point of view, even if you don't want to acknowledge it. So, you know, I think the ignorance is worse and just an excuse.
You went to Haiti with certain kinds of expectations, and I guess part of these expectations were driven by the headlines that you'd read, and I suppose imagining that within one day you would meet every headline at every turn there. What did you find when you came there? And this was 5 days before Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc, fled
right.
The country.
Well, what I found, I talk about this a little bit in the book, what I expected was something like what Graham Greene had described in his book, darkness, evil, you know, a brooding fear over everything. And in fact, what was happening was a lot of organizing against Duvalier. And so there was more of an open feeling of incipient revolution. And that was very exciting to me, and in fact had not been in the headlines until someone in the State Department said that Duvalier had already left the country. So I went down there, and I was confronted with openness and excitement instead of brooding fear and corruption. But that only lasted a little while.
You've used the word evil twice to describe Haiti. What mm-hmm. do you mean by that?
Well, I mean a situation of repression, corruption, and exploitation on the part of the government. A situation where anyone who wants to do any good in Haiti is either exiled or silenced or assassinated. And, you know, that's what it was like down there, and I consider that evil. I consider that there is evil in other countries. I don't think of Haiti as the sort of black republic, of the nightmare republic, as Greene described it. I don't think that's true, but I think there have been times in Haiti's history where that has been the case.
Covering a small island like Haiti, a small country like Haiti, what were the kinds of obstacles that you faced, and also covering a situation that was both volatile and dangerous, what kinds of survival skills did you learn as a journalist?
Well, I learned some silly sort of practical things from being in demonstrations where the police fired on us. You know, you learn what kinds of things you can hide behind and will protect you and which ones won't. Like, automobiles don't really protect you from automatic fire. So you learn little things like that that seem kind of funny in retrospect but are very practical at the moment. And on the larger scale, the obstacles to reporting in Haiti are, it's very hard to be on both sides. It's hard to be objective as a reporter in Haiti because there's so much suspicion, and if you are talking with opposition leaders and then they find out that you're hanging out with the Tonton Macoute, who are the old militia of François Duvalier, they're his secret police, the opposition leaders can get a little nervous, and, you know, there's a lot of fear of spies down in Haiti.
Were you afraid of endangering any of your sources?
I think I was very careful, but yes, I was sometimes afraid, not so much of endangering their lives, but just of giving away secrets that I shouldn't be giving away, foolishly, not even realizing it.
My guest is Amy Willents, and her book is called The Rainy Season. It's about Haiti after Duvalier, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. What happened to the revolution that got rid of Jean-Claude Duvalier in 1986? It looked as if there was a short-lived celebration after he left, but what happened to the movement that got rid of him?
Well, first of all, revolution is a very gross misnomer, I'm afraid. What happened was the people were organized, more organized than they had been in years before the fall of Duvalier. And they finally managed to get together and put so much pressure on the powers that be, the U.S. State Department, the Tonton Macoute, the army, and Duvalier himself, so much pressure that it was felt politic to get rid of Duvalier. In other words, what I think really happened, and this is obviously with a lot of hindsight, is that once Duvalier was removed, it was felt that that would lessen the intensity of the movement and that would sort of cork back up the movement. You get rid of him and then the people will calm down, was the feeling. And that didn't really happen. What happened was that people continued to demonstrate against what they felt was Duvalierism without Duvalier. And that movement was then fairly rapidly repressed by the new government that was installed.
The present-day violence that you're talking about within Haiti, you mm-hmm. seem to trace to Haiti's early beginnings. It was a slave state first ruled by the Spanish and then the French. There was a successful slave revolt that went on for 18 years that finally drove the French away. This early and difficult beginning for Haiti, how do you see that in its present-day politics, in its present-day life?
I think you have to remember that not only was it a bloody and violent and unprecedented revolution, that is, a slave revolution against the colonizer, but it was then followed by a general abandonment of Haiti as a world nation.
In other words, abandoned by the world.
Yes, because this was a slave revolution. You can imagine how the United States and France and other slaveholding countries felt about a country whose slaves had risen up against the masters. They were not too pleased. And they refused to recognize Haiti. They continued to sort of block its trade. And so it was, first of all, it was a pariah in the world, in the world's view. And then second of all, I think it was very hard for the slaves who had taken over and who had been brilliant, brilliant generals to then set about building a nation, because the nation was divided and they did not have a model that they knew of, that they had grown up with, on which to base such a state. They were slaves and all they knew was the plantation or the older ones, the tribes back in Africa. So they didn't have that much of an idea of how to build their new nation, and I think that the country has suffered from that. But also remember, this was a very early revolution. The other Caribbean nations did not get rid of the colonizer until more recently, like 30 years ago, 20 years ago.
And this was a revolution that took place in the 19th century.
Right. 1804 was the year of independence from France.
So what kind of system then filled this political vacuum?
Well, I'm afraid that a system of sort of big rulers with a lot of men around them grew up around this, almost a tribal thing, although I hate to say tribal because I think occasionally it can be interpreted as racist. But that sort of thing happened. There were fiefdoms, there were large landholders who had a lot of power in their areas. And then there was the central government, and the central government was really a government that exploited the peasantry. But in terms of doing anything in the country, you know, building things, stuff that we expect of government, they didn't do a lot of that, and they still don't.
Is that in part because of the isolation of a new and struggling country the way Haiti was?
It's in part because of the isolation. It's in part because in order to be recognized by France, Haiti agreed to pay a huge amount of debt. And so this was a terrific problem for Haiti for almost 100 years, repaying their debt to France. Just for recognition, just for recognition. It's an incredible story. And then it's in part because Haiti was at the time, for a long time, considered important geopolitically in terms of its strategic geographical position. It guards the other side of the Windward Passage with Cuba, and that was an access route to the rest of South America at the time. So there was a lot of foreign intrigue going on in Haiti, and I think that served to destabilize governments and corrupt governments also.
How was François Duvalier, who ruled Haiti from 1957 until 1971, how was he able to consolidate his power?
I think he was one of the cleverest politicians who's ever ruled in Haiti. He came to power sort of on a proto-black power movement. And He had a lot of popular support at that time, and he very quickly realized, being an astute historian of his country, that he was going to have problems with the army, which was at the time, in 1957, U.S. trained and mulatto in color, and not very well disposed toward the black middle class.
And we should interrupt to say here that the power struggle, part of the power struggle in Haiti, seems to be between the mulattoes and the blacks.
Yeah, there are lots of questions of color and class in Haiti, obviously. So he decided to dismantle the hierarchy of the army so that there would be no strong man who could really challenge him. In order to do this, he had to establish an armed force of equal weight. So he established the Tonton Macoute, which started as the Volunteers for National Security, I believe. Yes, I'm trying to translate from the French. And they were quickly nicknamed the Tonton Macoute, and they were an army of what is called in German social history, Untermensch, the underman, people from the slums, people who had no money and no authority. And they were like a Gestapo. And they were used by Duvalier, they were well treated by him, and if they were not paid, they were allowed complete authority in their little region of control. And therefore, they were completely loyal to him, and they would do anything.
Tonton Macoute means Uncle Boogeyman, which to my mind means two different things. Uncle being a more affectionate term, and Boogeyman obviously being a scary person.
Right. Well, Macoute means, actually, it's a straw bag that the peasants carry around with them. And Tonton Macoute is an actual figure from Haitian nursery tales. He is the guy who comes around in the middle of the night. He's like an evil Santa Claus, and he takes bad children and puts them in his bag and takes them away forever. So he's a figure that you would use with your child. If your child was bad, you would say, Tonton Macoute is going to come and take you away. And that was obviously adopted by the people, I believe, not by Duvalier.
So the Tonton Macoute was used against the army.
It was used against the army as a parallel structure that would protect the president. And one major figure in the army was assassinated under Duvalier. The military academy was closed. That was the training ground for the officers. So he effectively destroyed the most powerful men in the army and then had the Tonton Macoute to ensure that they would not be able to lead a coup d'etat.
One of the people that you interview says that in order to understand Haiti, you need to understand voodoo, and that Haiti is a religious state like Iran and other countries around the world. How much do you understand voodoo?
I think I understand it very little. I mean, you just feel watching it, and I've watched a lot of ceremonies, and I've seen how people behave because of their belief in voodoo. But watching it, you feel that unless you could manage to believe it in some way, that you'll never really understand it. And I remain a skeptic about all religions, so I don't feel I really understand any true believer.
Then do you not understand Haiti?
Well, maybe I don't. And I think that's something that perhaps gives my book a little extra authority, is the admission of the lack of understanding. I think a lot of foreigners have written about Haiti as though they understand everything. You have to remember that you're an outsider, and you will remain an outsider no matter how much you love the country and want to be one with the people. But you do learn, you observe it as a foreigner and in an intellectual way, and you learn about voodoo structures, which are very authoritarian and rigid and clearly delineated. You learn about just how deeply the people can believe in this and how that can control their lives. A lot of foreigners who've gone to Haiti come back saying, oh, voodoo is so beautiful, it's such a wonderful thing. I'm not someone who necessarily believes that.
Well, what do people who believe in voodoo then believe in?
They believe in a universe that is constantly overseen by the gods, in which, it sounds like any religion, in which any act of yours is noticed and taken into account in whatever will happen to you next, so that anything that happens to you is perceived as full of meaning. If you trip, that means something. If your child becomes ill, that means something, and it's because of something you did or failed to do. It's like any other religion, but it seems more so somehow because it's peasants who believe it. I just think it's extremely rigid in its belief in that everything is predetermined.
Haiti is an exceedingly poor country. How has the poverty affected life there, since it seems to permeate everything?
Well, I'm of the opinion that the poverty is the most important thing in the current political crisis in Haiti, and perhaps in the old political crises also. The poverty is so severe there that since I went to Haiti, I've been to other third world countries, and they all seem blissfully happy, sort of fat and content. Burma was one of them. What happens in a country where you have such terrible, inescapable poverty is that any amount of money can corrupt almost anyone. Obviously, there are great and brave exceptions. And so you end up with people who should be on one side, just by the conditions of their lives, working against themselves for a couple of dollars and a bottle of rum. And it's a very, very bad situation for organizing.
You say that 1.5 years after Jean-Claude Duvalier left Haiti, that it's harder to be on the streets, people are hungrier, people are angrier. What does that say to you about the future of Haiti?
Well, that was 1.5 years after Duvalier fell. This is now 1.5 years later, so the situation is a little different. What it says to me about the future of Haiti is that the possibilities for organizing against corruption and oppression are so limited, and it's so difficult to do, that it's going to take a very long time before real change, as opposed to this ostensible revolution that overthrew Duvalier, is going to come to Haiti, and that it has to be done, organizing has to be done quietly and outside of Port-au-Prince and with peasants and very slowly with a new bunch of people who have had their consciousness raised, maybe some kind of change can come, but that it's not going to happen in this kind of spurt of excitement supported by the United States and the Haitian army. That kind of thing is never going to be a real change in Haiti.
Have there been any changes since Duvalier?
Yes, I think the major change is the freedom that the press has had in the past 3 years. But even that is now being curtailed. Radio Soleil, which is the Catholic Church's radio station, has just been, as they say in Creole, swept out. The church fired 7 of its most well-reputed journalists, and now it's just broadcasting music, I think, if it's even broadcasting at all.
Where will the leaders of what will come next, where will they come from?
Well, people who hope the best for Haiti say that they hope that a leader will arise from the peasantry in the next 10 years, 15 years. And I think, if such a leader could emerge, that would be the greatest thing for Haiti. Her original leaders were such men. And Haiti needs someone who understands the peasantry and doesn't just want to live on their backs, you know, like a monkey. So that could be a place where a leader will come from. And there's a lot of organizing going on in the countryside to stop the exploitation of the peasant and to make him aware that he can refuse his labor in exchange for putting pressure on the big landholders. There's a lot going on, but it's more low level. It's not the kind of thing that would inspire newspapers to send journalists down to Haiti.
Why is your book called The Rainy Season?
Well, it sort of came to me in a vision one day when I was standing on a little terrace and the rain started coming down, and I saw just everything being swept away down the hill, all the rain, and a little boy riding down the rain in a banana leaf. And, you know, it just seemed to me such a great image. Here's this incredible rainstorm. It's taking away all of Haiti's topsoil, of which there's hardly any left anyway, and sweeping it into the sea. And yet it's so hot out, and everybody's so glad for the rain. You know, it just seemed to embody for me all the different problems in one meteorological image.
Well, Amy Willents, thank you for talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot, Marnie.